Pulitzer Prize-winning author Annie Dillard makes this comment about Christians in America. Why do people in churches seem like cheerful, brainless tourists on a package tour of the absolute? Does anyone have the foggiest idea what sort of power we so blithely invoke? The churches are children playing on the floor with their chemistry sets, mixing up a batch of TNT to kill a Sunday morning. It is madness to wear ladies' straw hats and velvet hats to church. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews, for the sleeping God may wake someday and take offense, or the waking God may draw us out to where we can never return. She's got a point. We are so prone as Christians and in our churches to kind of manage God's power, to accomplish our goals, our agendas, our desires in life. But the Bible teaches us that to manage God's power is to deny God's glory. The Israelites in 1 Samuel chapter 4. Now I know it's been a few weeks, but you've got to come back to 1 Samuel now. 1 Samuel chapter 4, the Israelites tried to manage God's power, and they were soundly defeated by the Philistines, and the ark was taken in to the camp of the Philistines, and now they controlled the ark. And now, in 1 Samuel chapter 5, the Philistines try to control God's power, and they will also pay the price. Now, some very weird things will happen in these next few chapters as we study them. But the point is simple. We dare not harness God's power to pull our wagons. That's not the way God works. God's power will surprise us. God's power will shock us. And God's power will even hurt us if we fail to fear God. The power of God must not be treated like any other powers. Chapter 5 of 1 Samuel, let's read verses 1 through 5. Now the Philistines took the ark of God, and they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And then the Philistines took the ark of God, and they brought it to the house of Dagon, and set it by Dagon. When the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon, and they set him in his place again. But when they arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon, literally the Hebrew says, only Dagon was left to him. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this very day. There are two ways that humans try to manage God's power. There's the Israelite way, or perhaps we could call it the religious way. The way that religious people, spiritual people, try to manage God's power. And there is the Philistine way, or perhaps we could call it the non-religious way, or the pagan way that people try to manage God's power. In either case, God is treated like an idol, essentially, that does what we want him to do. Now, in 1 Samuel 4, we saw the Israelite way. We manage God's power when we are using God's power to make us successful. People like to worship God. They like to go to church. They like to be religious as long as it's helpful to them. As long as God makes us successful, well, that's great. We're happy with that. God exists, after all, to meet our needs. God exists to make us happy. God will make us happy as long as we use the right formulas to get God to do what we want. That's the way many religious people think. The Israelites found out that God's power doesn't work that way at all. Now in 1 Samuel 5, we're going to look at the Philistine way of managing God's power. We manage God's power anytime we are treating God like any other gods or like all the other gods. That's essentially managing God's power. He's just one of the powers out there. There are many paths, and they all come to the same end after all. You can worship Allah, you can worship Buddha, you can worship Jehovah, but they're all just different gods, and all of them deserve our respect. Well, the Philistines, and moderns who think that way, the Philistines will find out that God's power doesn't work that way either. The Philistines were part of what historians call the Sea Peoples movement, which is a mass migration of people from the area of the Aegean Sea, which today would be modern Turkey, the island of Crete, and some of those areas, to the coastline of what we call Palestine today. They came to the coastal plain of this region, and they set up their new empire here. And they developed a powerful empire of city-states that controlled this coastal region. The name Palestine, by the way, in fact, is derived from the name Philistine. The Philistines have just defeated Israel in battle, chapter 4. They've captured the Ark of the Covenant. They bring the Ark of the Covenant to the city of Ashdod, which is located on the coast, is one of the five major city-states of the Philistine Empire. The city of Ashdod was a commercial and military power with a good port for shipping merchandise, for fishing. Ashdod was also the location of a major temple to the highest god in the pantheon of gods for the Philistines. His name was Dagon. The Philistines were polytheists. They believed in many gods, not just one god. They believed in many powers, and they respected all of these powers. But their top god, so to speak, was Dagon. Dagon may have been the fish god, or he may have been the grain god. Scholars are divided over what the derivation of the name is and where it comes from. But either way, Dagon was a typical god in the ancient world. Gods were worshipped because they brought success to the people in certain areas of life. That's why you had lots of gods, because you had lots of areas of your life. In other words, the people invented gods that gave them what they wanted in life. They believed in gods that fit their view of what life should be like, brought them success in life. That's the way it is even today. People invent a god that they can believe in because that god fits what they want to believe in with respect to life and blesses what they want to do in life. Now, the Philistines view the ark like an idol. After all, this is the way they would think. Dagon was their god. The Israelite god was the ark. Seemed like a rather odd god, after all, because ancient gods were usually figures of some sort. But after all, this is the Israelite god. We've got him now. Let's use him. He's a powerful god. They were well aware of the Israelite god, what he'd done to the most powerful nation of their day, the nation of Egypt, and how he had brought them into this land. They knew all that history, and they respected this powerful god. The ark was brought, the ark being Israel's god now, was brought into the temple of Dagon and was placed beside Dagon in that temple. Now, the Hebrew text is very clear here. It was placed alongside of Dagon. It wasn't someplace else in the temple. It wasn't below Dagon. It was placed beside or alongside of Dagon. They were willing to honor the Israelite God, but only as one of many gods. That's what polytheism does, after all. Polytheism honors and respects all the gods. They all have powers. We certainly don't want to tick this one off. He's just beaten by Dagon. Dagon's more powerful, but we sure don't want to, we sure still want to honor and respect this one. When we were in Rome a few years ago, we visited the Pantheon, which was originally a temple built by the Romans to honor what? All gods. In fact, originally, the Pantheon had all of the idols, all of the gods of various peoples around it, and it was a way to honor all the gods, to honor them all for their power. They might be of use to us sometime. That's the way polytheists think. Well, the Philistines were willing to honor the Israelite God as one of their gods, but of course not as a god greater than Dagon. The one true God, Jehovah, however, refuses to be treated like one of the gods, one of the powers. Jehovah is exclusive. He will not be brought down to the level of all the other gods of this world, all of the gods that humans invent to meet their needs in life. The next morning, the priests enter the temple to find Dagon on his face before the ark. They set him up again on his pedestal, only to find a greater sacrilege the next morning. This time Dagon has his head and his hands cut off, and they are lying on the threshold of the doorway, while Dagon is lying on the floor in front of the ark again. By the way, in the ancient world, victorious armies, when they went through the battlefield, they would cut off the heads and or the hands of the dead soldiers and bring them back as trophies of their victory. So the symbolism here to the Philistines is the head and the hands of Dagon are off, they're cut off before the ark of the Israelite God, before the Israelite God. So Jehovah wins, Dagon loses. Now, the Hebrew author, I think in this chapter, is clearly finding some humor in the story. For he says very specifically, the New American Standard translates it, the trunk of Dagon, but literally it's Dagon himself was lying before the ark. Now, that means Dagon has no head and no hands, but Dagon himself is lying before the ark. He's nothing more than a piece of rock. He cannot put himself back on the pedestal. The priests have to do that for him. He has no head. He has no hands. By the way, the next verse, in verse 6, there is juxtaposed here a very important phrase for all of these chapters, and that is, the hand of Jehovah, the hand of the Lord, was heavy upon them. So, here's Dagon, no hands, Dagon. And here's the hand of the Lord, who doesn't have any visible hands, but he's more powerful than the hands that are cut off, the hands of Dagon. The author finds humor in the fact that even years later, as he is recording this history, as he is writing this account, it is still well known that the priests in the temple of Dagon in Ashdod still do not step on the threshold of the temple. They step over it because that's where the hands of Dagon were cut off and fell. He's making fun of them. Superstition comes from idolatry. Superstition ascribes power to things that have no real power. In May of 2006, a woman named Bimbala Das, married a snake, a cobra to be exact. Because Hindus venerate cobras, the residents of Atala, India, believed that Mrs. Das's marriage would bring good luck to their town. Commenting on her relationship with the snake, husband, I guess, Doss said, "We communicate in a peculiar way." Apparently so, because snake charmers were unable to lure the cobra out of its home for the marriage ceremony. Instead, a bronze replica of the cobra was used as a stand-in for the marriage ceremony. According to the British Office for National Statistics, when asked to identify their religion in Great Britain in 2001, over 390,000 people wrote for their religion, the religion of Jedi. In fact, more people in Britain wrote Jedi as their religion than Jewish, Buddhist, or Sikh. Jedi was a greater religion in Great Britain, this is 2001 now, than any of those. Now, those of you who know, Jedi is a fictional character in the Star Wars movies. They are the warriors who fight with the nifty laser beams of light. They're a religion. In fact, 390,000 people wrote their religion in as Jedi, hoping to get it recognized as a legitimate religion in the country of Great Britain. Actress Halle Berry said, "I believe in God. I just don't know if that God is Jehovah, Buddha, or Allah." We live today in a world that is being called postmodern. The Enlightenment, historically, brought in modernism. And modernism believed that the world was rational, it was reasonable, you could reason everything to a successful conclusion. And so the law of non-contradiction was important, and all of the principles of rationality were important as a result of the Enlightenment and in what is called modernism. The problem is that the world didn't get better and better. Disillusionment set in, and disillusionment led to what historians are calling the period of postmodernism, which is the period in which we live now. And in postmodernism, reason means nothing. It's not a reasonable world, after all. In fact, that's why it's so difficult to talk to people today, because the law of non-contradiction means nothing. It doesn't matter if things contradict one another, because reason is no longer significant. What is significant is mysticism and spirituality and powers. They can be totally contradictory to one another. But that's what's important today. Folks, we are not less superstitious in postmodernism. We are more superstitious today than we've been in years. People today believe in all sorts of spiritual powers, including fictional ones like the Jedi. Postmodern man is not so much an atheist or even an agnostic. Postmodern man believes in many gods. He is a polytheist. Polytheism is intrinsic now, is inherent to American culture. There are many paths to spiritual enlightenment. We must respect all of those powers, all of those paths, all of those gods. Is that not what we're taught today? People today are inventing the gods they want to believe in because those gods fit their idea of success in life. Recently, the Portland Press Herald ran a news story about the religious movement here in Maine to support gay marriage. You might have read some of that. In that article, one religious leader was quoted as saying that she could not believe in a God who was against gay marriage. Can't believe in a God who's against gay marriage. Notice the emphasis. She cannot believe in a God who is against what she believes in. She could not believe in a God who functions in a way she doesn't believe. In other words, her God was invented by her. Several years ago, I was in a symposium on religious life here in the Portland area, and after the meeting, two members confronted me on the stairway to say that they thought evangelical Christians would attract more followers to their churches if we would be less exclusive and realize that all paths to God have value. So, it's pragmatic. We'll just get more people. It would be more attractive if all gods are equal and we respect all paths to spiritual enlightenment. But folks, that is simply polytheism. That's simply postmodern polytheism. All gods have equal value because we invent them to suit our needs. Any god we invent, folks, is not worth worshiping. If I can invent him, he's not worth worshiping. The one true God is exclusive. The God of the Bible says that he will not be treated like any other gods or powers in this world. He is the one true God, and he demands we submit to him and his ways, even if we don't like them. The Philistines had to learn that lesson the hard way. Second principle, the glory of God must not be shared with any other glory. Verses 6 through 12. Now the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them, and he smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. When the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is severe on us and on Dagon our God." So they sent and gathered all the lords of the Philistines to them and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" And they said, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath." And they brought the ark of the God of Israel around, and it came about that after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city with very great confusion, and he smote the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. And it happened as the ark of God came to Ekron that the Ekronites, being smarter than the rest of them, cried out, cried out saying, "They have brought the ark of God of Israel around to us to kill us and our people." They sent therefore and gathered all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel and let it return to its own place that it may not kill us and our people." For there was a deadly confusion throughout the city. The hand of God was very heavy there, and the men who did not die were smitten with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. So verse 6 begins with this phrase, "the hand of the Lord." And this theme of the hand of the Lord is going to run through chapter 5, chapter 6, and chapter 7, all the way to chapter 7 and verse 13, where we read in 7 verse 13, "And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel." Obviously, God doesn't have a physical hand. Like Dagon had hands, God doesn't have physical hands. God's hand is a metaphor for his exclusive power, and God's power controls man's destinies, not the other way around. It doesn't matter whether God is someone we want to believe in or not. It doesn't matter if God fits our idea of how things should be done or not. He's still God whether we believe in him or not. The one true God will never share his glory with any other glories in this world. He tells us that in Isaiah. The one true God just won't be one of many paths to success. We can't use God for our goals. Christianity is not merely one of many political action committees seeking to get our way in the government. God is above all governments, including the American government. No matter who is president and whether we like him or we don't like him, God is in control. God sits in the heavens and he does exactly what he pleases, he tells us. His ways are beyond our ways. His mind is beyond our minds. Now that's a God worth worshiping. The hand of the Lord was heavy on the Philistines. Didn't seem that way at first. He allowed the Israelites, God's people, to be defeated. Many died in battle. The ark was taken. I'm sure that many in Israel were wondering, what is God doing to our country? We're supposed to be his people. We're supposed to be successful. And now God has allowed the hated pagan Philistines to win and to take the ark, and now the ark's in their temple? What's God doing? But God knew exactly what he was doing all along. The defeat was his way of setting up his victory. God would win. God always does. The hand of the Lord was heavy on the Philistines. The Philistines were governed by a coalition of five city-states in the coastal plain. There was Ashkelon, Gaza, Gath, Ashdod, and Ekron. Each city had a lord of that city, a king of that city, and they had a coalition where the lords or the kings would get together and decide how they would work together. But they were basically independent city-states. Many scholars believe that the ark was originally intended by the Philistine lords to travel between the city-states. It was supposed to be sort of a victory parade or a victory tour, much like we would take a trophy, like the Celtics trophy or the Red Sox trophy, and we'd go around from city to city, and all the people could cheer, and it would be a celebration, a victory tour. And that Ashdod was simply the first city in the tour of the five cities, that they intended all along to continue through with this victory tour. However, before the ark could travel on the victory tour to another city, God's hand was heavy upon the people of Ashdod. He struck the people of the city and its surrounding villages with tumors. Now, the Greek translation of this term is the word hemorrhoid. He struck them with hemorrhoids. A hemorrhoid epidemic. Well, I told you there's some really weird things in this passage, all right? It may well be that that's what he did. But there are some indications that whatever these tumors were, they were very serious, because the text talks about death as a part of that epidemic. It talks about the fact that those who didn't die from the tumors still experienced the pain and aggravation of those tumors and cried out in agony. Verse 11 talks about a deadly confusion, and the Hebrew word for confusion is a military term. It was used of people in battle. When this word was used, it was used of a massacre. A horrible defeat in battle where people were killed, massacred by the enemy soldiers. So it's a deadly confusion that took place. And furthermore, in the next chapter, we will learn that there was an infestation of mice or rats that was associated with this event, and that the Philistines connected the mice with the tumors. And that has led many scholars to surmise or speculate that it was some sort of bubonic plague that was involved here, with its deadly tumors and its infestation of mice and rats, which could very easily have come off the ships in the port cities there. Of course, bubonic plague, if not treated immediately, results typically in about 50% of the time in death. Well, regardless, these people are in pain. They are in agony, and they knew exactly where to point the finger for their pain. And the lords of the Philistines met to decide what to do. They decided to send the ark to Gath. Now, I don't know whether Gath wanted it or not. Maybe the king of Gath was simply the weakest of the five kings, and he kind of got stuck with it. I don't know. At any rate, the same things happened in Gath as Ashdod. Tumors, terror, and deadly confusion filled the city of Gath and all its villages, so the kings met again and decided to send it to Ekron. I mean, this victory tour was turning into a funeral dirge. So the ark was brought to Ekron. The people there didn't want it. They definitely didn't want it. They rallied against the ark. They wanted no part of that ark. They screamed that their political leaders had brought the ark of the God of Israel to kill them. Get it out of here. Fear had replaced joy. Terror took over. Dagon's victory tour had turned into Jehovah's victory tour. Everywhere they went, Jehovah was winning. He was making them miserable. People were dying. They were in pain. It hurt to stand against the God of Israel. Jehovah was making sure that he did not share his glory, his victory tour, with any other glory. No way. Everywhere I go, God says, I'm the one who will be honored. He's the famous one we sung. My glory is mine, and this is my victory tour through Philistine territory. Jehovah is exclusive. To believe anything else is not to believe in Jehovah. After all, it was Jehovah who said, the first of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt have no other gods alongside of me. That's pretty exclusive. So God is enforcing his exclusive power over the Philistines. And God has, well, he has interesting ways of enforcing that power. He does so today as well. He is greater than and above all of us. And he is sovereign. The most powerful computer in the world has been the IBM Blue Gene L, housed at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. It can perform 280 trillion calculations a second. But that's nothing compared to the computer at the Department of Energy's Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. It's called the Roadrunner Project, after New Mexico's speedy state bird. Components for the computer began arriving in the fall of 2006, and it took 36 moving vans full of equipment to complete it. It was supposed to be finished this year. I don't know, maybe some of you know if it's been completed or not. It was supposed to be finished by the end of 2008. This one computer fills a room the size of a hockey rink and consumes as much power, this one computer, as an entire small town. Its goal is to be the first computer to do a quadrillion calculations a second. A quadrillion calculations a second. How fast is that? It is roughly a billion times faster than today's generation of desktop computers. It will be used to simulate the first few seconds of a nuclear detonation, virtual explosions that will allow the government to monitor its bombs without actually blowing them up. Isn't that nice? We do all of this for bombs. Even more mind-boggling than these facts, however, is that the human brain, your brain, processes information faster. Did you know that? Some scientists, somebody said amen, or somebody said, I don't know about that. Some scientists estimate that the brain carries out 10 quadrillion operations a second. That's 10 times faster than a supercomputer the size of a hockey rink. That's your brain. I'm not sure looking at you right now. But even as impressive as the supercomputer and the human brain, what about the brain of the person who made the human brain? Can't even begin to compare with God. Isaiah 55:9. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts. That's God. Author and pastor Kevin Miller tells about a family vacation to Toronto, where they all decided to go up the CN Tower in Toronto, the world's tallest freestanding structure at 1,815 feet. He didn't want to go up, but his kids shamed him into it. He's afraid of heights, he said. He was the last one onto the elevator, so he turned around. Why do we always turn around in elevators, by the way? He turned around and faced the door, only to his horror to find out that the door was entirely made of glass and that the elevator goes up on the outside of the tower. So as they're flying upwards, he's inches away from free fall. He arrives at the observation platform, thinking, at last I'm safe, stumbles out only to find, as he puts it, some sadist has decided to make it the floor entirely out of glass. So he's standing on this glass floor looking down at the earth far below. His kids are running around and jumping and lying on the floor. Come on, Dad, come on. He says, I wasn't moving. I knew this thing had been made by the contractor with the lowest bid. That same year, they went to the Grand Canyon, where you can stand at the south rim and peer 6,000 feet down. At the Grand Canyon, you are not separated from your doom by blocks of glass 2.5 inches thick. And every year, an average of 4 or 5 people die while visiting the Grand Canyon. Nobody dies. Nobody has died going up the CN Tower. But they do die at the Grand Canyon. But he said, the Grand Canyon is so beautiful, I had to see it. I had to get there. I had to look over the edge. As scared as I was, and knowing that people actually die here, I had to do it. And then Kevin asked this question. When the Bible talks about fearing God, what is it talking about? Which kind of fear? Is it talking about the kind of fear I felt at the CN Tower? Or is it more like the fear I felt at the Grand Canyon? I think often we teach people to fear God, and that means you're supposed to respect Him. You know, honor Him. And He's safe, so therefore it's irrational. It's irrational. It's silly to be afraid of God. And Kevin says, I'm not sure that's what the Bible teaches. In fact, I'm sure it's not what the Bible teaches, and I agree with him. He observes, it's like you're standing on the glass floor 1,100 feet up in the CN Tower. Being there may give you a thrill or a quick feeling of awe, but you're completely safe. So if you do feel any terror with God, it's unnecessary, even irrational. But when the Bible talks about fearing God, it means not just awe, not just reverence, it also means fear. It's the kind of fear I felt at the Grand Canyon, where I was drawn to the amazing beauty, but I also felt a realistic fear at the danger, because people who acted foolishly near it have died. That's real. And it is with God too. We are drawn to God's goodness. We are drawn to God's majesty and His grace. But if we play around with this God of majesty and grace, if we play around with God, we can die. That's real. That's fact. In the words of C.S. Lewis, God is not safe, but God is good. Father, teach us to truly fear You as we live our lives, knowing that people who play around with Your power actually die. Trusting in Your grace and Your goodness for our lives this week. In Jesus' name, amen.